Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's another week of Rebooting the News with me and Jay Rosen. Jay?
Hi Dave, how's it going?
I'm sick.
You're
in
sick?
A word.
Oh. Well, that's just what your body is saying. We're not addressing that part of you, right?
No, we're not talking about my mind.
Yeah, we don't care if the rest of it is...
Whoa, oh my God.
What's
no,
that?
That, you know what it is? I have it open in another window. That happened before. Wow, that was scary.
Is that a dog barking at us?
Oh my! No, right, that was Blog Talk Radio. I was about to hear my own voice again, but luckily I headed it off.
All right.
Anyway, you lead us today, Jay. Where are we going?
Well, we had an extraordinary
event. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I can't believe this. This is like a disaster.
No, that was Blog Talk Radio.
Holy jeez.
What is going on here?
Okay. I'm going to get rid of this now. Here we go. Okay, I think it's gone. I apologize for that to you and to everybody else.
I think people understand that this is a do-it-yourself show with no studio whatsoever. And we're doing it over the web.
Yeah, I do something about that, Jay. Anyway, I think it's over. That little glitchy weirdness, I think that's done with now.
This week, an extraordinary event occurred for those who use Twitter, which was this denial of service attack that knocked the service out for several days. And I thought we might begin just with a few reflections on that, because when you are trying to understand a system, a news system, a communication network of any kind, when that network goes down, you get to see what relationships it now has, in the same way that if people were sitting around a big table and suddenly the table vanished, they would discover what relationships they had among each other because this thing is gone. So anyway, in that light, this attack was very interesting to examine because it made me think about a theme we've been developing in our podcast of the centralization of Twitter and how much of that centralization do we really need and how much is purely in our way.
Mm-hmm.
And during the attack, as I was trying to figure out what was going on along with other Twitter users, communicating through other means like friend feed and things, I started to look back at it in its normal state. And it just occurred to me, why didn't Twitter just say, okay, move over here. We have this other place we can run our network, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like a radio station that was under attack could broadcast from its remote, its transmitter and create a studio there. Move the network. Why couldn't we just move the network? And also, this other question which I asked on Twitter of if the attack was targeted at one user, why is the entire service vulnerable to an attack like that? Not in the sense that any site can be reached by an attack, we know that,
mm-hmm.
but why is it so hard to protect the service from an attack like that, which I couldn't answer myself as a user. Anyway, those were some of my reactions. If you know what I mean by when it goes down, you can see what it is. I'd love to hear your reactions.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, it's absolutely true. It's the suspension of disbelief drops. You know, it's like a movie or book where you get so wrapped up in the story that you forget that you're watching a movie or reading a book. Same thing happens in computers and computer networks, is that, you know, it's you're not thinking about the mechanism by which you're achieving this community. You're just thinking about the community. And so when the connection drops, but you're still dependent on the, you know, all the technology is in play, and the minute it fails, that is when, you know, it's like the lights go on in the movie theater and you realize,
right,
oh my God, I'm in a movie theater. I'm not, you know, in the middle of wherever it is this story is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So Yeah, techies are users too, and so we totally experience it that way. The questions that you ask are very good questions, and for a technical guy, you have to kind of be patient and start trying to understand it from the other person's point of view, because we skip right over those questions as to, why is it that they couldn't, why couldn't they move it from one place to another? That was your first question,
Why couldn't we move the network to another location?
And the answer is the attack would follow you. The attack would go right there with you. It wouldn't skip a single heartbeat. It would just move and, along with you. Either that or the rest of us would have no way of finding it, and in which case it wouldn't be effectively a move. In other words, if let's say you move the radio station from, 98.5 to 95.3, somehow you'd have to tell everybody that it moved to 95.3 without telling the guy who's attacking him.
Well,
couldn't do that. And then as far as the question, why is it affecting everybody when they're just going after the one guy, that's centralization.
I understand that, yeah.
I know you understand it. And, in the course of, getting to the bottom of figuring out all the stuff that was going on this week, it became very clear to me how sophisticated you are as not just a user but also as a technologist, in the sense that you're, through whatever mechanism, are starting to think like we think. And so can't throw, a curveball at you for that. I know you understand that, and that the centralization issue is serious, because nobody can attack the entire internet. I knock wood, because I don't know if that's true. We've just not seen that yet.
I'm using you as my private tutor in technology, Dave, and then making a radio show out of it.
Loving it. It's great. I like it because I learn a lot from doing that. and vice versa, right? I use you as my tutor in history of journalism and practice of journalism. So.
I love your term clueless newbie, because it describes me sometimes, but I'm in that position quite a bit when it comes to technology. Clueless newbie questions bring out very interesting responses in people.
Yeah, well, I think clueless newbies are important, and I cherish my inner clueless newbie.
and that leads us right into a post you developed at your blog this week, which I want to ask you about, called Narrate Your Work, which also came about by checking one of your tools, if I understand it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you mean by narrate your work in a rebooted system of news? What does that phrase mean?
Mm-hmm. Should I briefly tell the story about what happened?
Yeah.
Okay.
So how you come upon these things?
Right. Well, there was this horrible plane helicopter crash in the Hudson River on Saturday, and first I heard about it was about an hour after it happened. I checked in with Twitter, and it was the typical sort of Twitter mess, in that there were people reporting quote-unquote breaking news an hour after it happened, so it was cluttered up with people pretending that they were CNN, it was kind of silly. And, and then conflicting stories about whether people had died, how many people had died, et cetera. Then I thought, okay, let's try going to NYT.100TWT.com, which is an aggregation of all of the New York Times people that I could find on Twitter. And what I saw there was something that I had kind of been expecting that I would see at some point in time, and recognized it immediately, is that now we've got a breaking story, and here's the A-B comparison. I've seen now, this is what the sort of, unwashed masses do with a story, and here's what news professionals do with a story as it's breaking. And it really was fascinating to watch them, And it was also fascinating to watch their guard go. I don't know how high their guard actually is in normal times. These tend to be pretty innovative people, I think, the New York Times people who are on Twitter. But they were just, you could see they were in the flow of a big story or an interesting, or I don't know if it's big or whatever.
Okay, so let me clarify what you just said. You checked your service, which collects just what the New York Times people are saying on Twitter.
Right.
You looked at the period just after the crash so it could compare it to the flood of information and misinformation as the crowd, as it were, discusses it on Twitter.
Right.
And you looked at the differences and saw, wow, the way they're talking among themselves as they figure this story out is itself valuable and key to the future of news.
That's correct.
Okay.
And an exemplar of that. And
so how do we get to the channel talk with the pilots and the air traffic control tower? Because that's the thing that drew me into your comparison.
Well, okay, so there, scoot all the way to the end of the piece, which called Narrating Your Work. There's a guy named Len Pryor who used to work at Microsoft who started a web service called Channel 9. And the purpose of Channel 9 was to emulate the voice channel, the cockpit channel on airplanes. And how you can flip through the different channels they have, you know, jazz tunes and popular hits. And then there's Channel 9, which is just listening to the cockpit guys, the pilot and co-pilot and engineer, whoever else is up there, talk to various people that they talk to, the towers, other airplanes, or whatever. I don't find it all that interesting. I generally just skip right over it. But some people apparently really are fascinated by it. Mm. So he did that, and he actually, this is where Scoble got his start at Microsoft. He was the chief reporter for Channel 9. And their idea was, we're just going to go interview all of the programmers when products are in development and shipping and get them to tell us about what they're doing and what they're thinking and why the product is the way it is. And and I've always felt that was, you know, as a product developer myself, I always felt that there's a story there that is usually not covered. And it's important because when the product goes through all the stages of communications, well, there's everything is lost in terms of the process that yielded the product and a lot of the thinking behind the product. And then there's this connection between the minds of the user and the mind of the guy or people who conceived the product. And there's a lot of information that gets lost. And so I thought it was fascinating that they were doing it. I don't use a lot of Microsoft products, so I wasn't really a big user of it. And then I just wanted to add one more thing. This connects up. I think the guy's name is Cody Brown. Is he a former student of yours?
Yeah, he's a former ex-student of mine last spring at NYU. He's an undergraduate.
He wrote a brilliant piece that compared Twitter makes the analogy between MySpace and Facebook and Twitter and fill in the blank. What will the Facebook of Twitter look like? And he draws this Venn diagram of all the things Twitter is. And in the lower right-hand quadrant of that Venn diagram is the news system.
Right.
And that's what I think we got a glimpse at. I think that's what we're constantly getting a glimpse at.
Yeah.
And I think we got to look at a new part of that.
Yeah.
This weekend.
I see what you're saying, yeah. Let me reinterpret that, and then I have a comment I want to make about this air tower image.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Cody is saying is that MySpace presented a jumble of systems overlaid on one another, and progress was sort of looking at what they resolved into. And he says, similarly with Twitter, starts as a blob, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it resolves into the separate systems that are really just using it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the reason they're using it all at once is just the accidents of invention and, right, some of the arbitrary things.
Well, he's more specific. Cody is a lot more specific. He says because they didn't have a clear vision of what the system was at its outset, whereas Facebook did. Facebook started focused on the Harvard student.
Right. And so it's the arbitrary system versus the intention. What will be the Twitter look like when we build it with intention, right?
Well, and go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I want to go back to this image of the of Channel 9, you said it was, and the idea of the control tower, because there's a very potent parallel between what the pilots and the controllers are doing and what the people in a news system are doing. If you look at the job of a newspaper editor, let's say, in the glory days of the Philadelphia Inquirer, where you reproduce the Inquirer, right, the newspaper, every 24 hours, you start the day with a certain number of stories that you have scheduled, are supposed to come in, you just assign them, they're on the board, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those stories is very much like a plane in the sense that you have to land it by this time in order for the newspaper to take off and fly mm-hmm. to the presses and make it, right? And
mm-hmm.
as a editor, you are very much in this position of, I got all these balls in the air, and they all have to land, right? I got all these planes, and they all have to come back. Of course, some are not going to come back because things don't work out, and you have to scramble like the controllers do. And so this image of listening to the controllers, it's like listening to the editors and the reporters as they try to land their planes
mm-hmm.
and work out the story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I have talked to professional journalists about this whole question of opening up your process, to put it as crudely as possible, of being more transparent about their work, there is a universal first reaction mm-hmm. to any question of this kind or any attempt to open the matter for inspection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't want to give my stories away to my competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fear of losing the story by telling people you're working on it.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion is that instead of like arguing about that or reacting to it, we simply say some stories cannot develop except in the dark room. And then there are these other stories that are better done in a more open way.
Mm-hmm.
And the new system has to allow for both.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be part of it that is not only where it's not only allowed, it is constructed so that confidentiality in reporting until the moment when you have the story is preserved, because some stories can only operate that way. There's a whole lot of other ones that are much better when they are openly conducted. And then there are forms in between, which is part of the art of it. So we have to build both. We have to ask journalists to be transparent about the things that make sense
yeah.
to be open, and also provide better ways for confidential information to be passed in the construction of public knowledge, in the construction
right.
of great news stories, in not to benefit insiders, but precisely to give it an outlet to the wider world.
I'll go with that. I mean, you know, I don't think there would have been any way to stop that story on Saturday from being completely wide open because the nature of the story. And I thought one of the fascinating aspects, I mean, there's trade-offs. If you do not share your process publicly, you don't get the benefit of the public participation.
Totally. No, and
right?
I think in that story, it's totally an example
and they
of
were
an
getting
open process working. Yeah.
They were, and it was really,
yeah.
that's one of the most lovely things about it.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that it was the New York Times reporters, but it served as a point of integration. They
totally.
Were pulling in the information that they were getting from, you know, this is what we call curation, right? I mean, this is that, you know,
it's more than that, Dave. It's for big breaking news stories like that.
Right.
The open way is a better way. It is better
right.
than
we're,
anything the closed shop had to offer.
Yeah. I don't really understand. I mean, I kind of do understand why they need to be private about things, because I have analogs in my world, you know, that there are things that I work on that if I were to open up the process, that would just kill the idea right at
of course.
Right
yeah.
off the bat, you know,
right.
because then it would become a you know, not for the same reasons, but similar reasons. So, yeah, I don't want five people working on the same story that I'm working on, because
right.
at the end, that would destroy the unity of the division, and it would not be the same product at the other end, and it would not be a good product.
So. Well, exactly. So when you get that reaction, that's the first reaction, again and again, hundreds of times, it's telling you something, that you're hitting something that is very important, right? So I think by making this practical distinction, a good integrated rebooted news system has to be very good at accepting confidential information and keeping it so long enough to
mm-hmm.
create a great story, and it has to be very good at being open and sharing not only its own information, but a sense of where it's going, so that, and also sharing credit, with just operating in a very different way. And for some stories, the open way is better, and for other stories, a complete Fort Knox approach is best, and then there's a range of things in the middle. So let's be practical about it. Instead
okay,
of
we're
having,
in a, yeah. Let's move on. Next story.
All right.
Idea.
So narrate your work, to bring it back to the beginning, means what? You should narrate your work. Means
you tell
what?
The story of what you're doing, and without thinking a whole lot about why or who's listening or whatever. It's just, this is what I'm doing now. It's the question Twitter asks. What are you doing now? I mean, Twitter is a narrate your work environment, you know. It is, you know, I don't know how much more to say. I mean, I kind of narrate my work myself, and the Times guys were narrating their work at that point. I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe I can't define it anymore, except I know that it's important. And I thought Cody Brown was getting onto something there, but I want to maybe at some point come back to that piece, because, or maybe suggest if he's listening to this that he work on the ending a little bit on that, because it just drifted off. And I think the interesting part is what comes next, you know, is I think there'll be five Twitters, not one or two. And
okay,
they will focus on the markets, not on the technology. He chose to go with the technology, and I don't think that matters as much as the applications. You know?
Let's put it on the board for a future reboot in the news.
Yes, sir.
Is what
okay.
Will Twitter resolve into? I think that's the question.
Yeah, exactly. Good.
I want to shift to an idea suggested by some of our more loyal users. Just see if it does spark anything in you.
Mm.
It relates to something that we've talked about before, about how do you serve the narrative as well as the update in a rebooted system of news?
How do you do what? Serve the narrative as
we've
well
talked,
as...
Yeah. How do you present both the back narrative that tells us why this is news as well as the update, which is today's news, right?
Yeah, we talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah.
Last week? Yeah.
And because now we don't have to think of delivering news stories in isolation from the background knowledge that animates them, right? We have this whole series of puzzles of how do we serve, like, all of this if people need it. So one of the ideas put forward by one of our listeners is, what if we adapted the idea of revision history in Wikipedia
mm-hmm.
to news? And we are able to visualize somehow how a story came together. We are able to click and see the revision history of a news article. What would that look like? And how would that help us build a better system for news? And it's very related to your idea of narrate your work, because it's saying that bringing people inside how we bring this together brings more of them together, right? I mean, it's the same a basic idea. If you show how you got there, you can be trusted to have gotten somewhere.
Sure. I don't think that's controversial. Yes, it's part of transparency. It's part of, you know, what Weinberger says, right? Transparency is the new objectivity.
Right.
Part of the problem with doing things in secret, right? I mean, you're definitely not being transparent at that point. You're kind of being opaque. But, yeah, so, I mean, I would go for the maximum transparency. But I don't know that I have anything to add to that. I think there's nothing, no harm in having a revision history for stories. I think it's a good idea. I don't think it's crucial. I mean, I don't know.
Revision history for a story is it a one level event? I was also thinking of revision history for a narrative. Like, suppose you have a huge ongoing fight, like, whether we're going to build this huge development and basketball arena in downtown Brooklyn, with a huge local developer and transform the heart of downtown Brooklyn with this massive development.
Mm-hmm.
Going on for years, still isn't built. Still, we don't even know if it's going to be built. But it involves the New Jersey Nets becoming the New Brooklyn Nets and a lot of other things as well. So,
is this the real story?
Yeah.
Is this really happening?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the lead developer for the project is also the person who helped the New York Times build their building, among other many other fascinating things about this story. The Atlantic Yards Project, it's called.
It seems like this story has been going on for a long time.
Exactly.
Isn't it the same story that they had about Ebbets Field and Robert Moses? And
well, it's related to the whole Brooklyn back narrative of losing their sports franchises and that as kind of like the mythical beginning of the decline of Brooklyn, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very powerful story. It involves powerful people, and it certainly is hugely important for people who live in Brooklyn. So that story has evolved over years, and it's undergone a lot of revisions, right? And knowing that, being able to present that with what just happened in the Environmental Commission's report really matters. And being able to bring a lot of voices, you know, around that story matters. And if we get better at the backstory, we'll get even better at presenting the new, the update, right? It's an idea that I think we should just keep coming back to.
Well, right, and I wasn't sure how specific you were being about the mechanism, right?
Don't have a mechanism yet.
Well, because I saw something there about revision history, and you know, and using that sort of
as a metaphor.
Okay,
yeah.
Because if we're just in the metaphor, then of course, and I would say everybody or as many people as possible should be encouraged to keep whatever form of narrative they are comfortable with. You know, for me, that would probably be a blog, you know, and that I would write periodic stories about what I'm doing with this. And so if I want to go back and find out, you know, what were the sequence of events that led to, say, for example, RSS 2.0, okay, I have a pretty good trail. I have actually a very good trail left behind me of the events that led to that. And, you know, unfortunately, the web sort of has holes in it, and there are big pieces that are missing. And so those you can't do anything about, which is another thread we should add to the list is, you know, and it's all related to this whole problem we're having. Are we going to talk about trim today? Is that one thing?
We could, yeah. Why don't we transition to that?
Just add this under the whole category of big holes in the web, you know,
right.
Messes that we're going to deal with in the future that are going
to. URL shorteners are a big hole in the web.
It isn't yet, but it's pretty clear it will become one, and you know, and it's always been a questionable foundation that we've been building on in this area, and you know, Twitter came along, and up to that point, you know, there had been tiny Earl, you know, .com, and it wasn't even a very important service. I mean, it was something that was just sort of taken for granted, and you
Right. Sort
the URL when you were going to.
I remember that,
yeah. Right. But then comes along Twitter, and it has the 140 character limit, and now all of a sudden URL shortening is serious business, and you're fighting for, as you pointed out, you know, you're fighting for every character, and so trim is better than bit.ly because it's one character shorter.
That's
right?
How desperate we are, yeah.
Well, we love that character,
pathetic,
right?
That's how pathetic we are.
Right. Now, never mind that the whole thing could be very nicely solved by simply removing the URL from the 140 characters and then letting it travel independently of the 140 characters. There's plenty of data that does that right now anyway. There's the timestamp, the name of the author.
Right. So this is the idea of the enclosure, right?
I'll take a screenshot for you to show you all the data that goes with the tweets. It's really impressive. The URL would be a drop in the bucket. It would be a very small addition, you know, and that's the best solution. That's just really what ought to happen. And they ought to drop this whole business about URL shortening. It's bad because, you know, we just learned yesterday that trim is going to disappear at some point. That's now the question is, what happens with all the trim URLs that are out there, you know?
Right.
Yeah, they'll break, all right? And Then this puts into play every other, and it's always been a question, Jay. It's not a new question. It's just one that now all of a sudden is coming home to a lot of other people in a new way. But eventually, Bitly will fail. And by the way, eventually Twitter will fail too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't extrapolate out 20 or 30 years from now and say for sure that you know that Twitter.com is still going to be operating.
Right.
Right. My guess is that Twitter.com will not be operating in 20 or 30 years. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at history, and these things do not last that long. But,
right.
But will my website, scripting.com, still be there in 20 or 30 years?
Easier to say.
I hope so. I'm doing things that I think will make it more likely that it will. And I'd like to do even more things that will make it even more likely. And I'll just mention briefly that there's a big event coming up at the end of the year with radio.weblogs.com, and this has been raised by several users, that site will be going away. And that's a scary one because there's a huge amount of my own personal history tied up in that site.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we're going to try to do something about that, see what we can do.
Right.
But
to work on the web is to fight to keep what you've done alive.
Yeah.
That's a very big part of it.
Right. And maybe we should try to take some of the fighting out of that and try to systematize it and turn it into an economic thing, a money thing. So that if you're willing to put aside, let's say I were willing to give $10,000 to some foundation and say, look, here's like a huge, you know, here's 20 gigabytes of static information. For $10,000, I want you to agree to do your best efforts to make sure that lives for 100 years.
Right. Actually, it's a good foundation project.
Yeah.
I want to move on if we can.
Yes, please.
I have a word to say about an episode in the old media that interested me quite a bit. The collapse and crash and burn of Mousepiece Theater at the Washington Post.
Did it collapse?
Yeah, well, it was killed by the editor.
Oh, really?
Who said
I didn't hear
this
about that. That's great.
Yes, indeed.
Do you take some credit for that, Jay?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I would take
Do you
credit
take
for
some delight
I would take
in
credit
it?
For spotting its awfulness early.
You certainly get that one. That's for sure.
Yeah, and sort of being relentless about it. And I pretty much thought that when the people at the Washington Post were forced to take a look at it, that they would kill it. I was pretty confident of that. But and I knew the ombudsman was doing a big column on it. And I think if Marcus Broccoli, the editor of the Washington Post, hadn't killed it, the ombudsman's column might have done so. But what I wanted to say about it is not a critique, which I have been making over the weeks, but more of a reaction to a thread in explaining how the Washington Post ended up doing something so relentlessly awful. And they said, well, it's good to experiment. And I had two reactions to that. And lots of people who actually thought Mousepiece Theater, which was supposed to be a parody of Mousepiece Theater, who thought it was pretty bad, nonetheless said, but it's good to experiment. And I wanted to react to that because my understanding of experiment is different than what I saw the Washington Post, Dana Milbank, and Chris Azzilla doing with Mousepiece Theater. What they did is they decided that in addition to reporting the news and commenting on the news and handicapping the news and being ahead of everybody else on the political news and columnizing from the news, they were also going to be very, very good at satirizing the news and satirizing themselves. And doing satire in video or on stage or on radio is really, really hard. It's one of the hardest editorial arts there is. But nonetheless, they decided in their spare time that they were going to be satirists of the news and ended up crashing and burning because it was just so bad and embarrassing at many levels. But it wasn't to me an experiment, Dave, because of what my idea of an experiment is. My idea of experiment is if you wanted to do this, the first thing you would do is you'd go out and you'd say, okay, what are the models for our success? And how can we find people who can help us do this? And who can we bring in that who's done satire, who can kind of like help us figure this out? And how do we know that we're being funny? And how do we share with the users what we're learning from doing this? And what's a successful news parody anyway? And, you know, and they would be open about what they were doing, and they would be listening to feedback, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what you have is people producing a god-awful bad satire that doesn't go anywhere, make any point, or make anyone laugh. And they're gambling the Washington Post reputation on it. They're putting it on YouTube so that a truly cringeworthy moment could rocket around the world overnight without them knowing it, right? They risk becoming a viral embarrassment. They aren't listening to any feedback because they keep doing it, and they end up in a crash and burn situation when they happen to call the Secretary of State a mad bitch.
Right? Well, they said she drank mad bitch beer, right?
All right, so
it's a
that
subtle
approach,
but you know,
okay, they said they
embarrassing, yes.
They said she drank mad bitch beer, right? Or implied, or anyway. So that was like the, you know, the final straw, as it were. But an experiment is different. The experiment says, here's what we're trying to do. We're going to get the best intelligence first about how to do it well. We're going to show you our progress. We're going to listen, right, to feedback. We're going to know through metrics how it's going, right? We're going to let other people see what we're doing so that they can try their own. That's an experiment. And if journalists proceed in that way so that we can learn from them, then, they get huge points, huge cred for doing it that way. That's my attitude.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that. Yeah. I think this was Church of the Savvy on parade, basically, which involves sitting around a boardroom table and thinking, well, we're like the best at everything we would possibly want to do, and here we have the opportunity to not only be all the great things that we already are, but be the outrageously funny people that we know we are inside, right? And
that's right. We not only give it to you, we also make fun of it for you.
Yeah. It's
and
so common,
we in smoking jackets. And the fatal miscalculation, looking at it from the outside, was that they thought they were being self-mocking. They thought they were being taking themselves down a peg, if you know what I mean, because in their minds, they're poking fun at the news, at what they do, right? And they didn't realize the way that trying to be good at satire and being our crackerjack political reporter totally on top of his beat at the same time isn't really poking fun at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's inflating your job. You know, it's going beyond your core competence.
There's a lot of that in there.
You know, and I don't know. It's the reduction to absurdity of the Church of the Savvy. Now, at the opposite end of that, I want to give a little shout out to some of the people I know who listen to this, who are just now getting into journalism or just thinking about careers in media or trying to help figure out a rebooted system of news. And I realize that one of the reasons that I'm not blogging as much and writing essays and doing the kind of work I used to do is that in this whole puzzle of how do we help the press transition to a new and very different world? How do we still have great journalism and still have a great news system in this transformed world? I realized I had been thinking about and working on basically that problem for a very long time, and I realized that I didn't have an answer to that. I didn't know how that was going to work. And that the best thing I could do would be just to start getting other people onto the right problem center and just start reaching them with my own best ideas, which fail at a certain point to carry forward. Because I don't actually know. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing. So I thought the people listening to Rebooted News might want to know a little bit about where I'm coming from, which leads me to another idea I wanted to float to this very group.
Mm-hmm.
Let's figure out what a rebooted byline looks like so that the byline starts breathing and living a little bit and not only tells me who wrote this or packaged or presented it, but where they're coming from.
What do you mean by where they're coming from?
Well, in the transparency is the new objectivity world, in that method of generating trust, it's crucial that I not only know that Dave Weiner wrote this, but where he's coming from.
You mean like Berkeley, California?
No!
You mean like Twitter.com? I mean,
no.
These aren't like silly jokes, because it actually is where I'm coming from, right? I mean, in other words...
Yes, I mean, it would be all of those things, that is what I'm saying. All
what community did this piece originate in, you know? And
exactly.
We're in so many different communities. And
what I'm saying, Dave, is let's figure out what the where I'm coming from part of the rebooted news system looks like.
Agreed.
How do we build that? What do we put there? Where I'm coming from isn't a static thing, right? It has to be related to what I'm telling you, right? And
what we will find, I think, is that the where I'm coming from is fairly deficient. And that's what we need to work on also, is creating a better where. In other words, you know, it's like...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's get some development work going.
Right.
Because the modern byline has to not only tell me who wrote this, but where they're coming from.
Totally.
So let's get to work on that. Source
of
inspiration.
That's what we're working on. I'm working on it, totally. As when I get off the phone today, believe me, that's what I'm working on.
We have how much time left?
Hey, we got about 3 minutes left for your inspiration. Who happened to know who it is because I read your notes?
Well, it can just be a conversation because it's equally an inspiration to you.
I think this would qualify as a joint inspiration.
Yeah.
But you're still using up your inspiration for the week. Why don't you tell us who it is?
Richard Stallman, who is the founder of the free software movement and a crucial figure in what we now call open source software.
He actually would dispute that and call it free software.
Right. That's why I said the founder of the free software movement.
Right.
And I didn't learn about him and probably until well after you did. But when I did, I felt an immediate attraction to this person. And I saw where he was coming from right away. And to me, what's great about him is, first of all, he's a Democrat in the deepest sense of thinking everyone needs their share in knowledge because everyone needs a share in power, too. But it's more that here's a person who, when he figures something out, will and feels he's right, because he totally thought it through from 55 different ways. If he feels he will write, he's right, he will create it. You know, he will, and it's the sheer force of will that drew me into his ideas. And of course, then I learned that these are really great ideas. And it's basically software that helps people should be available. The knowledge and code for it should be available to them. And
you have 60 seconds, Jay, by the way.
That idea is basic to what I feel I'm doing with journalism, trying to make it more open source. So give me your take on Stallman in 20 seconds.
Well, I think he's underappreciated. I think there's a lot of people out there that spin against Stallman so much that when I first met him, I was expecting him to be very, very different kind of person from who he actually is. He's very gentle. He listens really well. He has a very strong sense of right and wrong, and it yields in most all cases that I, well, every case that I've seen, yields the same answer. But sometimes there just is one answer, and sometimes there is right and wrong in this world. And I find that his compass is a pretty good compass.
Yeah.
And on that note, we got to go, man. It's been a great rebooting the news, Jay.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks.